Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of True Crime on Easy Street. I'm Katie Givens, and I'm still not a lawyer.
I'm Kelly Turner, and I'm not a doctor.
And I am Scott Wright, and I remain a mediocre journalist.
And we're back this week. We know some of you hate when we do two parts, but we're back. It's part two, so...
Yeah, deal with it.
It's over now.
It's happening.
We're here.
Yeah, this is the end of this two-part series about H.H. Holmes. And last week, we took a little bit of a lighthearted approach to the case of H.H. Holmes. We skirted the topics, really, of death and dismemberment that some of you may have been expecting. Not that we blame you, because, I mean, you were tuning into a true crime podcast about America's so-called first ever serial killer. We even told a couple of jokes that landed until Kelly began refusing to read them.
None of those jokes landed, especially the fishing ones.
What can I say? Mediocrity is my wheelhouse. Your husband completely agreed with you when we had this conversation on Saturday over at Easy Street, which is right here on this campus where we all are now. Mm-hmm. But we will take a more solemn approach to the matter of H.H. Holmes this episode because there will be blood today.
Kelly and I even asked Scott last week where the blood was because we were confused as much as all of you were, but
yes.
Yeah, I know. We didn't do a single thing about, and I didn't even realize it really until I had gotten to the end of it, but nobody died last week.
Well, people tune in to listen to Murder and Mayhem, and we just took a little bit of a different approach.
Well, we're going to make up for it tonight.
Well, we are, and we had to kind of set the stage for this. This H.H. Holmes has been done so many different ways by so many different podcasts, and Scott, you mentioned this to us many times, and that you wanted to take a little bit of a different approach. And
maybe too many times. Wow. No no's on that. All right, fine. Go with it.
But you wanted to take a little bit of a different approach, and I think you had to kind of take the moment last week and kind of set it up for this week. But yep. there's murder, there's mayhem, there's blood, all of it this week. For all you listeners out there,
there are specifically 9 murders this week. Mm-hmm. There are 9 known victims of H.H. Holmes, and we'll tell you about all of them, how they found themselves in the path of Holmes, and how they each met their fates. Then we're going to take you along on an investigative manhunt that eventually delivered him to justice.
Now, largely because of Eric Larson's 2003 book, The Devil in the White City, it's really hard to talk about H.H. Holmes or his so-called murder castle at the corner of 63rd and Wallace Streets without taking a little bit of time to discuss the World's Columbian Exposition, which was held in Jackson Park in Chicago in 1893.
And we'll hit the highlights of the Chicago's World's Fair, as the exposition was commonly called. That's probably what you've heard it called. If you want to learn more about the event, which was a celebration of the 400th anniversary of Columbus's discovery of the New World, we suggest a YouTube documentary titled Expo Magic of the White City.
That film's over an hour and a half long, almost 2 hours, and it contains a lot of photos from the World's Fair. And that's partly because Kodak had invented an affordable, easy-to-use, sort of portable camera in 1890, and by 1893, it was all of the rage, especially at the World's Fair in Chicago.
And I really had no idea that this type of camera came out that early.
Me either.
I don't know why I would have known, but it was called the Kodak No. 1, and it came loaded with 100 exposure roll of film that you sent off to be developed. So when you got the camera back, it was with the developed roll of film and the camera reloaded with another roll of film.
And I'm an advertising guy, so I thought this was interesting. Kodak's ad slogan for the camera was, "You press the button, we do the rest." So anyway, thousands of fairgoers over the course of that World's Fair in Chicago snapped images of the events. And as an extra treat, if you do take the time to watch that documentary, it is narrated by the late Gene Wilder, one of my favorite comedic actors of all times. He passed away in August of 2016. If you haven't seen Young Frankenstein, and I'm pretty sure that Katie Givens has not, so I'm going to drag you in front of a TV at some point and make you watch it, but Gene Wilder, one of my favorites.
Is that something they would have played in school?
Probably not in high school, but maybe in film class in college, because it's a masterpiece in comedy.
It's a
Mel Brooks film.
Yeah, it's a really
good film. It's Mel Brooks' best film. Any of you out there who want to talk about Blazing Saddles, fine, we will have that discussion. But to me, Young Frankenstein was the best one.
I love Gene Wilder, and he was the original Willy Wonka.
Yes, and the best one. the better of the two so far.
Are you insulting Johnny Depp?
I think I just did.
To me?
Whoops.
Okay, we'll deal with that later.
All right. Well.
So back to the World's Fair. Here are some highlights of the event. There was a mile-long midway that featured exhibits from cultures all around the world. Visitors to the fair, they could ride a camel, they could drink a German beer, they could ride in a hot air balloon, they could see a real-life belly dancer. There were 28 million fair goers. Is that what you call them? Fair goers.
I suppose so.
Yeah. So they got to go and do some really cool things that they couldn't do.
From the 1st of May until the end of October of 1893, that's how long the fair lasted. And
wow, that's a
28
long
million people.
Well, a Pittsburgh engineer named George Washington Gale Ferris designed and built the Midway's main attraction, if you could only guess what that is.
Oh.
Was it round?
It was the very first Ferris wheel. And this wheel wasn't like the ones that we see all over, you know, they come in the mall parking lots to this day. This was nearly 300 feet tall and could hold 2,100 riders at a time. That's insane.
That's a pretty big wheel. And if you're a fan of the old country singer Johnny Russell, you may recall his 1973 hit, Rednecks, White Sox, and Blue Ribbon Beer. And that song would never have existed had it not been for the 1893 World's Fair. Because a Milwaukee-based brewer named Frederick Pabst, bear with me, was awarded the top prize for his lager at a contest held during the fair. And so today we still have Pabst Blue Ribbon Beer. And when I say we, guys, if you will reach into the paper bags I have in front of you right now, let's all do this together. We're going to crack open PBR right here on the show.
Wow.
Right, on three. One, two, three. Yeah, and now everybody has a PBR, and that would never have happened had it not been. You know what? I'm not a beer guy. Wait a minute. Yeah, I'm still not a beer guy. That tastes like horse piss to me, because I am not a beer guy, but a lot of people are.
It has a blue ribbon. Style.
I know, but I just wonder what beer didn't win.
It's in a paper bag. It's got to be delicious,
and
right?
If they did it right back then, they still delivered it in a paper bag.
This is a very large can.
But that's the only thing I can find on short notice at the convenience store across the street. Sorry.
Yes, Scott brings us something in a small brown paper bag and tells us not to worry about it.
Yeah, he says,
don't worry about what's here. You'll learn eventually. Yeah, it's not my cup of tea.
You know what? That's not as bad as I thought it was going to be, actually.
It's not bad. It's not a Miller High Life. But, you know, it'll do.
All right. Well, it won first place in 1893, and we still have it today.
Delicious in 1893.
So way to go, Frederick Pabst and your employees.
I would like to know what beers it beat. That would be interesting.
Same here.
I'm going to say I don't want to try them.
Nor do I.
Well, the World's Fair showcased hundreds of inventions and innovations, including electric elevators, the zipper.
The zipper was brand new then.
The first ever.
Wait a minute. How did you hold your pants up before then?
Had to be buttons, I guess.
And suspenders and belts, because they finally figured out the whole zipper thing.
Well, my pants I have on right now don't have a zipper. They're button up.
Oh, well, there you go. I got a zipper here.
I mean, I don't. Mine are
just
leggings.
Trust me. I mean, nobody wants to reach over and find out. Trust me, it's a zipper.
We're not going
to
do that.
Yeah, I know, right?
Take your word for it.
We also had the first ever voice recordings and a novel piece of technology created by Alexander Graham Bell, which today we all have in our pockets, known as the telephone.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Cracker Jack was a brand new snack that debuted at the World's Fair in Chicago, along with Wrigley's Chewing Gum. Aunt Jemima. We say Aunt Jemima.
Aunt Jemima.
Aunt Jemima pancake mix. And according to at least one source, the hamburger.
Makes sense. Walking around at the fair, you need something you can eat in one hand, a hamburger.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It'd be so simple.
But that's like, you ask 100 people where the hamburger came from, and if they are hamburger aficionados, they can all give you a different story. Everybody has their hamburger Genesis story, and this is just one of the many.
So possibly the hamburger may have debuted here.
Yeah.
Every state in the Union and hundreds of countries from around the world displayed their wares at the fair. What are wares, Scott? You wrote today's
wares are, you know, I,
script.
I, It's not a script. It's an outline.
Outline.
As you have reminded me many times. Wares are their products, their devices,
their stuff,
their ingenuity, their stuff.
They debuted their stuff at the fair. That's pretty cool. All in all, the venue covered over 600 acres, which is twice the size of Disney's Epcot.
And I wrote that because I know that Katie just got back from Epcot and she walked around all day with her friends. And that's only 300 acres. So imagine twice as big as you walked around.
Yeah, that would take... I would think you would need more than one day to do.
2 weeks was the standard time.
Mm-hmm. People stayed and went for
back in the day.
Okay,
you couldn't take an airplane home that afternoon. So once you drove that or rode on that train for 2 days to get there, you just stayed for 2 weeks.
Makes sense.
Possibly at H.H. Holmes's Murder Castle, but we will get to that.
Well, the fairgrounds were also known as the White City at the time. And that was because electricity, I mean, it had been around since 1876 as World's Fair in Philadelphia, but it was nothing like what fairgoers saw every night in Chicago with all the lights.
George Westinghouse outbid Thomas Edison for the rights to light up the World's Fair, and he did it in abundance. Hundreds of thousands of light bulbs trace the outline of the gigantic buildings that house the fair's exhibits. And every day at sunset, they came to life with illumination.
All right, that's enough about the fair. We've talked about it ad nauseum, I believe, and we did it last week, too. This was just kind of a refresher course. But as I mentioned, the fair is an important part of this story because one of the better-known stories, as we just mentioned, about H.H. Holmes is that he took advantage of the thousands of anonymous people who visited Chicago in 1893 and allegedly lured some of them into his murder castle and got them down into that basement.
I imagine this would be a fantastic hunting ground if you are a serial killer.
It's according to a lot of the popular stories, that is exactly what happened.
Well, last week we told you that Dr. Herman Mudgett spent some time in upstate New York after he graduated from medical school in 1884. He hung around there long enough to get a job as a school teacher, creeped out some of his coworkers, and maybe committed a few crimes before he headed west to Chicago in the summer of 1886.
This is also when he changes his name to H.H. Holmes, at least partly because he was already a wanted man for the scams and cons committed as Mudgett in other parts of the country.
And remember, wife number one, she's back home in New Hampshire, living with her parents. So after Holmes settled in Chicago with a new job at Holton's Pharmacy, he married wife number two, and her name was Myrta Belknap, B-E-L-K-N-A-P. We covered all of this last week. This is just a quick refresher to get you caught up.
Yeah, and Mrs. Holmes number two, Myrta, she is soon pregnant, so Holmes sends her across town to live with her parents far away from his day-to-day operations. Mm-hmm. And there's already legal trouble flirting around Holmes in Chicago because he has a habit of buying items on credit and not paying for them and then hiding those items that he purchased. So when the representatives of those companies come back around to repossess their property, they're nowhere to be found.
They can't find it.
So with murder moved across town, Holmes was free to flirt with the young customers at his pharmacy. And if Holmes is going to be flirting and scheming to steal furniture for his brand new building and then not paying his invoices when the items arrived, he needs someone else to run the store and keep the books.
And that gets us to the fall of 1890. Enter the Connor family. Ned and his wife, Julia, and their 12-year-old daughter, Pearl. Holmes hired Ned to run the jewelry shop on the ground floor. Remember, we've got shops on the ground floor and then apartments upstairs and whatever else is going on up there. We'll get to that. And he puts the family in the upstairs apartment. So apparently, if you believe the story, some flirting ensues, and before too long, Ned figures out that something fishy is going on. I told you I was going to do another fishing joke, but that's the last one. Something is going on between Holmes and Julia, so he packs up, he hits the road, and he leaves Julia and Pearl in the apartment upstairs.
He just leaves his family. He's like, something's going on between y'all. I'm out.
Peace out.
Even the 12-year-old?
Yeah, I'm going to have to take a drink of beer on that one. Wow. It gets worse.
Okay.
Stick around. So much worse.
So Holmes and Julia, you know, they had something going on apparently, but then Julia's younger sister Gertrude comes to visit, and suddenly Holmes is much more interested in Gertie.
She's probably a little younger and a little bit prettier, perhaps.
I mean, he's always looking for the next girl, then something prettier, some, you know.
That seems to be a pattern.
Grass is always greener, yeah, so to speak. But I guess to him, the grass is always younger and not pregnant.
Yes. Not yet.
Yeah. So Gertie is actually going to leave town in shame. And so maybe she was pregnant, maybe not. But he had a habit of getting women pregnant.
Seems like a pattern.
I mean, I feel like they were there for it, too. It wasn't just him. But
yeah, sure.
But then he was done. And he would leave. Or he would send them away.
Yeah.
And so then Gertie goes away. And then his eyes are back on Julia again, originally, which was Ned's wife that he just abandoned.
And that just seems like a pattern that he had throughout his adult criminal life.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Well, throughout 1891, Holmes and Julia, they're together, and she's living upstairs in the apartment. Mrs. Holmes, number two, is on the other side of town, and she never visits the pharmacy. So it seems like Holmes' side hustle it's working out pretty well. And then Julia ends up pregnant. And this is where people start disappearing for real. Beginning with Julia and her daughter Pearl around Christmas time of 1891.
And eventually we learn that Julia probably died on the operating table while Holmes was performing an abortion on her. And of course, Holmes had no interest in having a 12-year-old child around. So Julia and Pearl, as far as we know, become victims number one and two.
And perhaps not coincidentally, it was about this time that Holmes began a lucrative trade and articulated human skeletons for use by area medical schools. Not long after Julia disappeared, Holmes sold a skeleton to a school in Chicago for $200.
And, I mean, no questions on where this skeleton comes from? Like, they just
not at the time.
Let people sell skeletons?
Kind of. It was a different time, medically speaking.
So it would seem, yes.
Well, the disappearance of Julie and Pearl gets us to 1892, and a few interesting events took place that year in other parts of the country. One is, in 1892 was the year Fernand C. Weiss was born in Texas, and if you're from Cherokee County, you know that that is the namesake of our wonderful Weiss Lake, F.C. Weiss.
Yeah, I mean, Weiss Lake's been around for a while now, and the other thing is that it was the year that the University of Alabama fielded its first ever college football team. They finished that year, Kelly, with 2 wins and 2 losses, and they were known as the Cadets. The Crimson Tide moniker did not come along until 1907, apparently.
Now, Scott, did they play Auburn that year?
Yes, Kelly, they did. It was the first ever Iron Bowl, which every college football fan in Alabama, and probably everywhere in the country as far as that goes, knows at least a little bit about, or at least they've heard of.
Now, Scott.
Yeah?
Who won that first meeting of Alabama and
Auburn? I felt like you could not resist asking that question. And I don't want to talk about it, really. I'll just say Roll Tide.
Yep. The final score was 32-22 Auburn. I have a photo. Actually, it's a picture hanging on my office wall.
Really?
Of this game. Yes.
Well, you know what? War Eagle.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Oh, yeah.
And that's the last one of those you're ever going
to
get.
Okay. Right.
But back to the advertised topic at hand. Emmeline Sagrand, age 24, was the third victim of H.H. Holmes. Emmy met her end because of her acquaintance with another man Holmes already had working for him, and his name was Benjamin Potzel, and that's going to be important. So,
yeah.
Benjamin Potzel.
Hang on to that.
So, Emmy moves to the city to work as a secretary for Holmes, but before long, she vanishes. According to Holmes at the time, she got engaged and moved away. Instead, she ended up in that basement after being smothered in the walk-in safe Holmes had in his closet. And we'll tell you a little more.
Yeah, we'll tell you about that. Mm-hmm. Like we said, it's 1892. The World's Fair is going to open the next summer, the following May. So Holmes has decided to add a third floor to his two-story building at 63rd and Wallace so that he can rent out rooms to travelers who are in town for the big event, the fair. After all, the fairground is only a short ride away on the city's new mass transit system called the Elevated Railway, which, if you've ever been to Chicago today, you know they just call it the L.
Holmes was busy scamming and scheming, selling his fake medicines, and overseeing the construction of the castle's third floor, which had to be a huge endeavor.
Yeah, big time. It's a whole block long.
Yeah. So it was 1893 before he, I guess, had time to kill again. This time, his victims were a pair of sisters from Texas named Minnie and Anna Williams.
And it's pretty much confirmed that the Williams sisters walked into the castle one day without getting into all the details in the summer of 1893, and they never came out again. And that's because a couple of years later, there were items that belonged to the two sisters that were discovered in the large basement furnace that Kelly mentioned in last week's show. And we will talk about more later.
Well, Minnie had been a private secretary to Holmes, who, it turns out, she was an heiress to a large family fortune back in Texas. It's probably around $75,000 in 1893 money, which comes out to about $2.3 million today.
Wow.
And Holmes was basically seeing dollar signs in his sleep. So he started concocting a plan to get his hands on her inheritance. Just about the time the fair opened, Minnie's sister Anna came to Chicago for an extended visit with her.
The three of them had a great few weeks together exploring the World's Fair in the Windy City. They saw the city's great buildings and lavish homes and visited the Union Stockyards, which offered guided tours to watch the slaughter of thousands of hogs and cattle every day.
I'm so skipping that.
That sounds like a...
What a
like
great
a
time.
Fun time.
I'm glad they shut that
Let's
down in
the 70s.
Let's go watch
some hogs slaughtered.
Yeah. I've been to Chicago. I'm glad I skipped that tour.
That's got to be the worst date to ever go on.
Yeah. Second worst. Castle's the first.
Maybe.
The Union Stockyards is second worst.
At least you walk out of the slaughterhouse,
right?
Maybe.
Yeah.
Seems like foreshadowing, but... One day, the sisters suddenly turned up missing, and Holmes was just as suddenly able to produce a revised will signed by Minnie. So, you know, a revised will of a young woman, leaving her fortune to a man named Benton Lyman. Later, it would turn out this name was an alias of Holmes's personal assistant, and... I guess you could call him his partner in crime. And like I mentioned earlier, his name was Benjamin Potzel.
Yeah.
So just all of a sudden, this lady has a will that she's changed. This young woman.
Brand new.
Has changed her will.
And then poof, 2 days later, she's dead.
And she's dead.
Or immediately after that, yes.
That's the reverend kind of coincidence.
How do we keep running across these same types of cases? But yeah, I mean, and according to Eric Larson's book, Anna died of asphyxiation after Holmes tricked her into going into that walk-in safe, and then he swung the door closed behind her. And somehow, some way, Minnie gets killed too. There's no specific information about that. We know about the stuff being found in the furnace later, but now we've reached a body count of 5 of our 9.
Well, the wife count is also going up because not long after the Williams sisters vanished, a woman named Georgiana Yoke became fiance, a wife number 3 for Holmes. And he was still married to the other two. So when Georgiana got engaged to Holmes, she believed that his name was Henry M. Howard.
Yeah, he's a dick like that, just changing his name.
And I've got a friend named Georgiana, and I had never heard another Georgiana until this
came up. It's a very pretty name.
Maybe that name came off the list of potential names after it was associated with Holmes for decades.
We always call her George, and she doesn't like that. But
I can imagine why.
It's been too long now, George. Sorry if you're listening. In November, Holmes and Georgiana hopped on a train and left Chicago for good. Maybe because they felt like they had to before the cops came knocking on the castle door. But along for the ride to the wedding ceremony in Denver, which took place in January 1894, were good old Ben Potzel and his wife Carrie and their 5 children.
And again, according to Larson's book, the attempt to defraud Minnie Williams out of her inheritance stirred up some interest in exactly how and why her will changed so abruptly. Kelly, you mentioned that just a second ago. So before too long, insurance investigators from Fort Worth, Texas, got the locals in Chicago thinking, hey, wait a minute, maybe we've been asleep at the switch for 5 years. So Holmes suddenly found himself facing a united front of angry investors and merchandise suppliers who had not been paid by the good doctor.
So everybody's coming for him at once, I guess.
Yeah, it sounds like it. So that's why he leaves town.
Well, speaking of that recently rewritten will of Minnie's, Holmes and Potzel made a few stops in between, but eventually hopped on a train to Fort Worth and tried to get their hands on Minnie's property there, or at least as much of it as they could carry before those investigators caught up with them.
This traveling crime scheme finally got Holmes incarcerated for the first time.
Thank God.
He attempted to scam a small drugstore out of some of its inventory in St. Louis, a city that was sort of a home base for Holmes and Potzel, while they were working their various schemes after they left Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
So we finally got Holmes in a jail cell, and that event turns out to be the unluckiest of unlucky days for him in more ways than one, because while in his jail cell, Holmes met another criminal, and he apparently began bragging about his skill at committing insurance scams. I mean, I don't even think he's really got away with this one yet. But
no, but he's thinking about it.
Yeah.
And so this criminal's name is Marion Hedgepeth, and he is a professional train robber. And for some reason, we don't know how long they were in the cell together, a few weeks maybe. So Holmes begins to bring Hedgepeth into his confidence, and he tells him about this con job he's coming up with, this insurance scam, and he even cuts him in on it. So all Hedgepeth has to do, he's got these nefarious connections all around the criminal underworld. He finds a crooked attorney that's going to help Holmes and Peitzel pull off this $10,000 insurance scam. And all he has to do is sit around and wait for his $500 check to come from Holmes when the scam is complete.
Can I just say that professional train robber, it sounds so 1890s.
Boom.
Yeah.
Welcome to my time machine.
Professional.
Or our time machine. We finally got back. We're in the 1890s and people still rob freaking trains back then.
But this scam that Scott's talking about, they're going to fake Peitzel's death and fork over another anonymous dead body.
Like that scheme we talked about last week where they find bodies, corpses, they dig them up. I mean, he's got this medical background, so it's not hard back in the day to just, hey, here's a dead body. It's Ben Peitzel. Give us our money.
So they would, yeah, they did that in medical school, right? Isn't that where we're
they talked about it supposedly, uh-huh. But never pulled it off. But the light went off years before, and now it's coming to fruition.
Well, all Holmes had to do to get away with this one, theoretically, was just pull it off and then pay Hedgepeth the $500 he promised him for hooking him up with the attorney that was willing to go along with the plans.
But guess what? Greedy ass Dr. Holmes never bothered to drop in the mail after he collected the 10 grand because the scam comes off. They pull it off, at least initially, but he doesn't send Hedgepeth his 500 bucks. Sort of an oops moment for Holmes's master plan, as it turns out.
So a few weeks later, Marion Hedgepeth, professional train robber, is sitting in his jail cell in St. Louis, and he's looking out for the scam to occur, and he's thinking about the $500, he's checking the newspapers, and he knows Peitzel is going to be the phony victim, and he knows it's going to happen in Philadelphia.
And keep in mind that Carrie Peitzel, Benjamin's wife, she was in on the scam. Maybe she was all for it, or maybe she was dead set against it, but she knew about it, according to most accounts.
Well, probably because, I mean, if you've got a dead husband, they're going to come looking for you.
Right?
I mean,
so she's got to be in on it.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's got to be. So this detail becomes important shortly because when Holmes puts this plan into motion and pulls it off, he can't do it by himself, as we just discussed. So some family member has got to go and identify the body that Holmes has presented to the insurance company, which is supposed to be Ben Peitzel, but not really Ben Peitzel.
And I guess, unfortunately for Ben Peitzel, Holmes never had any plans to find another freshly resurrected body to turn into the insurance company. All along, he planned on killing the entire Peitzel family, beginning with Ben.
So Peitzel set himself up as a businessman in Philadelphia using the alias B.F. Perry. And that was sometime in August of 1894. A few weeks later, in early September, a customer entered the building where Peitzel / Perry's business was located and found the dead body of an adult male.
So far, so good on the insurance scam, but with one major exception. The dead body that was supposed to be there to fool the insurance company into believing it was Peitzel who had died actually was Benjamin Peitzel.
So when Ben's 15-year-old daughter travels to Philly to identify the body, she is actually identifying her father, and she either doesn't know it because she's not in on the scheme like her mother, or she is in on it and is totally horrified. And that makes Benjamin Peitzel victim number 6.
Either way.
Oh, that's terrible. At this point, Holmes had Alice Peitzel with him, and somehow he convinced Carrie to let two of her other children, 12-year-old Nellie and 8-year-old Howard, stay with him for a while.
Can I just, how did he convince?
I think she still trusted him.
Does she know Benjamin's dead?
No way.
No, she thinks that it's a fake body.
She thinks he's just laying low and
he's out. Yeah, he's in another part of the country, laying low, waiting for the for the film to clear, or waiting for the scandal to clear, and then he's going to get the 10,000 and they go away.
That's why he doesn't have Carrie come identify the body. That's why he has one of the kids do it.
Maybe, because Carrie would have, because what they did was they covered his entire body, because Ben Peitzel's body had been horribly burned in the scenario that Holmes had set up. And so when Alice Peitzel came to identify his body, his entire body was covered except that they exposed his teeth. And apparently Ben Peitzel had something identifiable, easily identifiable about his teeth. And Alice looked, and I don't know if she either thought, wow, they did a really good job creating my dad's teeth.
Yeah.
Or, holy shit, that's my dad.
Mm-hmm.
But either way, that's all she saw was they cut out a piece of cloth and held it over his mouth so that she could see the teeth.
Mm.
So we'll never know.
Well, like we said, Carrie still believed that he was alive and the entire family would be reunited soon. She had no idea that anybody was dead. And then they'd be $10,000 richer.
Mm-hmm.
But Holmes knows that they've all got to go, and that's his plan. And over the next few months, he strings along both the children and their mother, letting them all believe they will be together again soon with Benjamin. Unfortunately for Holmes, he lets the girls write letters to their mother while they are traveling around the country. Holmes never sent those letters, but he did hang on to them, and that's going to be a major mistake for him.
Yeah, that's number two. And Holmes killed young 8-year-old Howard first, according to what we find out later. And he cut up his body and he burned it in a fireplace in a house he rented for a short time in Indianapolis. Another thing that Holmes did as he was moving these kids around the country, he put them in hotels, but they also rent a house for just a day or two. We'll get back to that. And that was in September of 1894. And he explained Howard's disappearance to the girls as he was still traveling around the country with them, with some lie about Howard being reunited with Benjamin, his father. But little Howard, he was victim number 7.
And Alice and Nellie become victims number 8 and 9 at another rented house in Toronto, Canada, in late October. He gassed the girls to death in a trunk and buried their bodies in a shallow grave in the cellar.
We know how the 3 Peitzel children became Holmes' final victims because of the investigative work of Philadelphia detective Frank Geyer, who had been involved in over 200 murder cases during his career. So this is a seasoned detective.
Oh, yeah.
He knows what to look for.
Yes.
And what he's using are the letters written by Alice and Nellie that Holmes never mailed to retrace the path Holmes took while he had the children with him and eventually pieces it all together.
Yeah, Geyer got on the case because Holmes was arrested for that insurance scam eventually because somebody at the insurance company and the Pinkerton agency figured out, hey, wait a minute, this doesn't look right. This may actually be Ben Peitzel, and this we're going to have to investigate this further. And remember that Hedgepeth... this is really how this all happened. Hedgepeth, the train robber in the Chicago, the St. Louis jail, when he didn't get his $500, he reached out to the warden at his prison and said, hey, I know this whole scheme. Here's what really happened. And that's when the Pinkertons got after Holmes.
Sure. I mean, I'd roll over on you too. What does he got to lose at that point?
Yeah, I mean, $500 is 30 grand in 1893.
You might even get a little leniency because you're bringing in a serial killer.
Yeah.
I don't know that he knows that at this time.
I'm sure he was looking for extra dessert when he did that, or whatever, but yeah.
Well, Holmes is locked up in Boston in November of 1894, and he's charged with the murder of Ben Peitzel. Under questioning while he's in jail after being transferred to Philadelphia, Holmes won't tell the police anything about where the 3 children are, so Geyer heads off to find them.
So just what a jerk.
Yeah.
He's just not even
on top of everything else. He's stone cold busted and he's still bullshitting about where the kids are.
Yeah. So Geyer found the remains of the 2 Peitzel girls first in July of 1895, and then Howard's remains a short time later in Indianapolis. Holmes continued to deny killing anyone for now while he was sitting in a prison. Holmes continued to deny killing anyone for now while he was sitting in a prison in Philadelphia throughout 1895. He writes his memoirs and admits to being a criminal and a con man, but he continues to maintain that he is not a murderer.
Those memoirs proved to be a futile attempt to persuade the people of Philadelphia of his innocence, because in November of 1895, while on trial, it took a jury only 3 hours to find him guilty of Ben Peitzel's murder. He climbed up the stairs to the gallows on May 7th, 1896, but weirdly enough, the rope did not break his neck. So when the executioner sprung the trap door, It took Holmes about 20 minutes to strangle to death.
Sadness. And now, finally, we get to the basement. The whole nation has heard about Holmes and his murder castle by now, thanks to the yellow journalists of the era. In July of 1895, while Holmes was awaiting trial in Philly, Chicago police finally got into Holmes's murder castle, and what they found was a house of horrors.
Airtight rooms with no windows, rooms with gas jets that could only be controlled from Holmes's office. And in the basement, a blood-streaked wooden dissecting table, blood-stained surgical instruments still in their trays.
Poorly buried human remains, a wooden barrel that once contained corrosive acid, a pit of quicklime in the dirt floor of the cellar, and that oversized furnace slash crematory. Back upstairs in Holmes's office, police found a footprint of the inside of the walk-in vault believed to have been left there by victim number 3, Emmeline Sagrand.
Well, I just wanted to say...
Go, yeah, please.
Is this going to play a role in why it was so quick? I mean, the jury deliberating.
I think it was
hours.
A different time back then. You didn't have... The legal system was very much different, and maybe our not lawyer can jump in on this, but the legal system was so much different 125 years ago than it is today. If you were convicted of murder back then, you got a date in 6 months, and you didn't have this years-long appeals process
that
you did now.
Well, I'm just talking about getting that guilty conviction, you know, because they go into the murder castle in July of 1895, and then he's on trial in November of 1895. So did they use all of this?
No, but remember, he's only convicted of the murder of Ben Peitzel. They never convict him of any other murder. He's never put on trial for anything else.
Okay, so they don't put it together with all the...
No, they don't try to make like a federal case. That didn't exist back then. You didn't have the federal violation of your civil rights cases that we have now when something like this happens. He was convicted of the murder of Ben Peitzel. He never went to trial for any of the other 8 murders that we have talked about here today.
Okay.
So it was just that one.
All right.
And so before Holmes choked to death at the end of that rope, he did confess to 27 murders. I mean, he's sitting in the jail cell from November of 95 to May of 96, waiting for his day with the executioner. And so he makes another confession. He says he killed 27 people. But the thing is, some of those 27 people actually turned out to still be alive.
So on top of everything else, he's just a liar. Just straight up to the very end.
And speaking of the end, good night, everybody.